Number one, Bill is the deacon in charge of the setup and tear down here for Bible class, and we would like to redo the setup list for beginning for January of next year. I believe you're in charge of it this month, right? Okay, so if you're on the list and don't want to be, please notify him. If you are not on the list and want to be, notify him. If you're on the list and you still want to be, notify him anyway. So he will have a number of people who want to do this, and then he will make out a schedule and then get all that back to you. Secondly, we had our monthly board meeting yesterday, and it was unanimously decided that we are no longer going to allow non-members to attend any formal meetings of Grace Bible Church. Any deacons meetings are not going to be open to non-members. These will be open to members only. So that is going into effect immediately today. Thirdly, we are going to have a nursery meeting at some point in the future, hopefully this month if we can get to it. To determine those who want to be in the nursery, we probably will look at the nursery schedule again. We will try to get people the maximum amount of time in Bible class, obviously, that we can. That's our goal. And so we are going to have the established thing is we've got intercoms now, our walkie-talkies. And so we want a male member of this local church to take charge of that so that they can organize that and make sure everything is done. We perceived of only three reasons you would have to contact us from the nursery, although there may be more, and if there are, please inform me since I'm in charge of that area. And that would be is if we had a medical thing where we needed a nurse. So we would hope our ER nurse would jump up and run and help anyone who was dying or deathly ill. But we're not going to make her. Or if you need a parent because a child is needing some sort of discipline or something, we figured that might happen. And so we had these things initially set to silent. Or the third thing we thought of that might happen is there could be an intruder. Obviously, I know when everybody's in there, or they should be, those doors are supposed to be locked anyway. But we cannot lock the glass door because of other constraints on some members of the congregation. So we can't do that. So we want a male member to take charge of that. And there might be things that we did not perceive, but we figured medical, parental, or intruder were the three things we could think of. And so we will have a meeting sort of telling you what to do if you need a nurse, you know, I need medical help, or if you need a parent, the specific parent, you know, you would name them, code red means we've got an intruder or whatever, and you got to go. And probably everybody will jump up and leave then. So that'll probably effectively put an end to Bible class. Okay, and then the last announcement, there will be a brief meeting of the members. We will cut second session short today, probably by about 15 minutes, and there will be a brief meeting of the members at about 11:45. And we've decided all the way, by the way, another announcement in that regard is that all meetings and all issues that we are going to handle in the future, we are not going to handle at the beginning of Bible class. We will allot time at the end to handle them, so that we do not take time away from Bible class, and we have maximum amount of time, since we only have 4 hours a week as it is, we want maximum amount of time devoted to that. Okay, we are ready to move on here now with verse 14. Therefore, I want younger widows to get married. Obviously, again, this would create a real problem if the phrase back in the early part of this, having been the wife of one man means married only once. Paul would now be effectively disqualifying all younger widows from future support. And while that might be a rarity, it could happen, certainly. So I don't see a contradiction here, but again, I tend to view that phrase in its broadest interpretation of faithful to the principle of right man, right woman. Therefore, I want younger widows to get married, to bear children, and to keep house. That is the third complementary infinity we have here, which completes the thought of I want them to what? And this word is oika despoteo. O-I-K-O-D-E-S-P-O-T-E-O. This word is a compound from oikos, of course, which means the house. And, of course, the house can refer to both the physical structure or those that live in it. In this case, it refers to keeping house, i.e. running a household, and all that that entails. And then this is where we get our word despot from. And the idea is that of a ruler. And so this word, by the very nature of it here, indicates that it means to direct or to rule or to manage a household. That the wife, certainly under the authority of her husband, appears to be, sort of, we would say, the queen of the house. That she is the authority in there to deal with matters. And again, under the normal situation that is envisioned both in the Bible and what we know of life, generally speaking, the men are out making the living and the woman has to do all those things that are incumbent upon keeping the household running properly, i.e. buying the food, cooking the food, cleaning, all the things that she has to do in order to effectively run a household in an appropriate fashion. So I want younger widows to get married, bear children, keep house, and give the enemy no occasion for reproach. There is no and here. That, as you see, it's probably, it should be in italics in your New American Standard. There is no chi. Medeis is the adjective. M-E-D-E-I-S. It means not one, literally. Not one. And then you have this term, aphormen. A-P-H-O-R-M-E. It's used seven times as a military term. It means the starting point for a base of operations. And it comes to mean, in a more general sense, an occasion or an opportunity, and that's how they've translated here, is by the word occasion. But understanding the military background to this, that this means not one base of operations. To give, again, another complementary infinitive, this in the negative clause here, not one opportunity to give, didymi, the simple verb to give, the enemy is the definite article, the dative masculine singular, plus the present deponent participle of antikaimai. A-N-T-I-K-E-I-M-A-I. This word means to be opposed to someone, to be hostile, to be an enemy. Here is a collective singular. The participle would indicate that these are sort of fixed enemies, that this is something they engage in, we might say, on an ongoing basis. So it's a collective singular here for the negative, not ingative, negative, I misspelled that one, that would criticize Christianity because of the behavior of younger widows. And again, this gets into the cultural norms of the day and what was perceived as normal behavior in the Roman Empire, even. That this is not just necessarily unique to Paul or Christianity, that women were viewed as having a, quote, particular place. Now, some may see that as good, some may see it as bad, some may hate it, but that's the reality of the world in which we live. And Paul wants them to, as it were, occupy their proper position. So give them, give the enemy no occasion for reproach. Here is loideria. L-O-I-D-O-R-I-A. This is speech that is insulting, designed to slander, to revile. And then you got the genitive here of the preposition. Interestingly enough, the preposition ends the sentence here, or ends the clause, charin, C-H-A-R-I-N. It's not used a lot in the New Testament, but it's used with a genitive, and the idea here is on account of or with a view to maligning believers. Give the enemy no occasion to do so. For some have already turned aside to follow Satan. For is inter-explanatory conjunction here, gar. Ade is not translated here. Oh, yes, it is. I'm sorry. It's translated by the word already, E-D-E. This word means now. It's an adverb, already, by this time. For some, again, genitive, indefinite pronoun tis. Some widows, it's a feminine, so you would translate it, some widows would be the group in view, have already turned aside. And then, again, this gives me, and I think documents the point, that Paul's quite aware of some stuff going on, that this is not simply him writing again off the top of his head, that he knows of situations that have degenerated into this. Some have turned aside as ektrepo. E-K-T-R-E-P-O. Five times when used of physical injuries, that means to dislocate, like you dislocate your arm or shoulder or whatever. Here to wrench something or to turn aside. Some have turned aside. They translated here the preposition apiso, O-P-I-S-O. Of time, it means after. Spatially, it means to be behind someone, and that's how it's generally translated. They've turned aside behind the Satan, behind the adversary. So some people have deviated from the straight and narrow, possibly because of violations of this, possibly because the local church put them on full support and it created problems for them. They flunked the prosperity test. We're not really told who or why, but the reality is here that Paul views this not as just some mere matter of organizing and having your widow's list done decently and in order, that some people engage in the work of Satan in their lives. They actively fulfill it for him. And then, of course, here you've got the Satan, Satanas. This word means the adversary. That's the root meaning behind the word Satan. So, therefore, verse 14, based on these considerations, based on logic, that's another lost art in America. They don't teach it in schools anymore. People cannot think logically. They think emotionally. They don't think logically. And that gets you into all kinds of trouble. I want younger widows to get married, to bear children, to keep house, and to give the enemy no occasion for reproach. Obviously, the first three we would view here, these infinitives, I would think, as the positive aspects of the godly woman that would prevent the negative clause, that would prevent the enemy from having a legitimate thing to reproach them about. For some have already turned aside to follow Satan. Verse 14 begins with the inferential conjunction, which is designed to provide the conclusion to the matter of God's will for younger widows. Since Paul recognizes the spiritual hazards that these younger women will face once they have lost their spiritual head. And he's obviously, again, while this may seem harsh or cruel, in my opinion, it's designed to be a protection. It's designed to help them. So, two, in an ideal world, and that's where we all live, right, the ideal world, Paul recognizes that the single niche is the most conducive for serving God, since there are less distractions. That is the harmonization of the 1 Corinthians principle with what we have here. But we also recognize, and history has told us, and plus the Bible makes it plain, most people are not going to live a single lifestyle all their lives. That person is in the minority. Now, Paul says, if you can, do it. That this is a better thing spiritually in that regard, because if you're single, you have more time to devote to prayer, you have more time to devote to helping other believers, you have more time, you generally just have more time that's not consumed with having to run a household, keep a family, raise kids, and all that. And any mother here can tell you that takes a lot of time and effort and work to do all those things. And again, even a wife can tell you that the house doesn't clean itself, let's say. If you find one of those, let me know. My wife will want me to buy it. So 1 Corinthians 7:8, but I say to the unmarried and to the widows that it is good for them if they remain even as I. And again, some have tried to play this off against the Timothy passage and say Paul's contradicting himself. No, he's talking about in an ideal situation. And he gives very specific guidelines on widows that will modify this in some way or explain it even further. And also 32 through 35 in that same chapter. But I want you to be free from concern. That's his goal. I mean, it's the ultimate spiritual good of believers. One who is unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. Which is rightly so. You've got to make a living. You've got to pay the bills. You've got to do all those things that are incumbent upon you as a man. And as his interests are divided. And the woman who is unmarried and the virgin is concerned about the things of the Lord, that she may be holy both in body and spirit. But one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. And I say this for your benefit. As Paul spells out, you got to sometimes, I'm not doing this to try to hurt you. But not to put a restraint on you, but to promote what is seemly, what is proper, to secure undistracted devotion to the Lord. So three, single people are much more free to become engrossed in spiritual pursuits since they do not have the responsibilities that married people do. Four, it is obvious that married people have to set aside sufficient time for their marriage. And marriage is one of those things that it, from time to time, you're going to find out as a believer, if you're married, it can be work. It's not always easy, and it's not always hard. It's not, you know, it's like anything in the Christian life. Every day isn't just la, 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 I'm Big Bird tripping down Sesame Street. And everything isn't just grind nose to the grindstone, I don't have any fun, or life is just a drag. It's a combination of these things. So, again, we recognize that you have to set aside sufficient time for your marriage. And you have to cultivate that. And that requires time and works in some cases. And, of course, it yields a very beneficial result if you do it right. And that's the challenge. And if you do it right, then you end up being married to the same person for a long, long time. And you live a happy life and productive and all of that. Again, you have to set aside sufficient time in running a household that detracts from the time they could be engaged in spiritual pursuits. That's not to say while you're vacuuming, you couldn't be praying. But we're saying that obviously that is a distraction if you have to do it. Five, based on the statement in Corinthians. Some have attempted to argue that Paul did not write both of these letters. Paul was there dealing with the general rule of thumb. While here he is dealing with the specialized class of younger widows, and I might say younger widows only. He's not, there Paul talks in generalities. And we recognize that there is sort of a general rule. The general rule of 1 Corinthians 7 is bloom where you're planted. Stay where God puts you. But there are clearly exceptions to that rule as there are to every rule. As we saw in the life again of Jacob. Got out of the geographic will of God, went out of the land, and as near as I can tell, made the maturity adjustment. So that makes you have to stop and think, well, wait a minute, what's all this? Maybe we've overstated the importance of, quote, the geographic will of God. We think it is important because the general teaching of Corinthians says stay where you're planted. But that might not be the will of God for every believer all time. And so we can certainly envision, one of the things we have in the doctrine of pastor-teacher is that, generally speaking, you might only have one pastor all your life. Some people may not. Some people may have multiple pastors. Now, they can't have them at the same time. We're not advocating that, plurality of teachers and all that. But we recognize that, hey, there's exceptions to this. And you have to be flexible. When you get this tunnel vision, and it's all this way and this way only and never changes, you're going to make some horrible mistakes because you're not going to take into account various factors that might arise. And you have to be careful with overstating a doctrine. And I think in some cases, this doctrine of geographic will, I had to rethink that when I did the book of Genesis. Now, I'm not saying just willy-nilly go wherever you want and you can just do whatever you want at all times. That's not what we're advocating. But we are advocating that perhaps it could happen. And we saw it in the book of Acts there with Philip. He's a deacon. I mean, can you imagine the scandal today in a doctrinal church if a deacon quit and went somewhere else? There wasn't even another church. There was no indication that there was a church up there at Caesarea where he settled. Maybe he founded one. We don't know. But we have to acknowledge, well, this event did occur. And so, I think sometimes it's easy to overstate things, and we don't want to be guilty of that. And sometimes we've had to back off on certain things. I know, again, we had the joke in seminary that, under the doctrine of separation, I'll separate from you at the drop of a hat and drop my own hat. Well, that's not really the nature of the doctrine of separation. Further time and growth and study has revealed to me that separation is an extreme doctrine, not the one you have to apply every minute of every day. And so these things, again, you have to consider them. Think through them, and it's difficult because you have to challenge yourself sometimes. And that means challenging your own theological grid of where it may be weak or wrong, or you have to change some things. And again, this is why you can't follow in lockstep with just anybody. As a pastor, you've got to think for yourself and make your own decisions and study the Scripture under the Lord, under the ministry of the Holy Spirit for yourself. So five, based on the statements in Corinthians, again, he's dealing with a general rule of thumb. We got general, widows, very specific. And those are different things, and you have to recognize that. Six, Paul is intelligent enough to recognize that the theoretical ideal of all people remaining single, men and women, is not the most sensible given the nature of temptations that the younger widows will face. And if all people remain single, what would happen to the human race? I think it would come to an end. Assuming they were single and celibate, I guess. Factor that in. A lot of single people are having babies, we know that. But the human race, if there was no procreation, if there was no marriage, the human race would end in a generation. So Paul isn't advocating that. He just recognizes that, look, in an ideal world, you could serve the Lord better as a single person. But how many of you who are married want to go back and be single? Now maybe I shouldn't ask that. let me rephrase. You got married because you wanted to. You like the companionship and the camaraderie and the support and the, you know, and when the marriage is good, it's wonderful, isn't it? And I would encourage people to get married, you know, but if single niche is your niche, that's fine too. And that's all. It's up again. We have to allow for volition, individual believers' choices, and all that. So seven, in that regard, Paul is quite realistic about the nature of the sex drive, which has led many people into compromising doctrine and becoming involved in inappropriate relationships. Eight, obviously, Paul cannot force younger widows to seek out a second marriage in violation of their volition. All he can do is counsel and give advice and tell them what he perceives the will of God to be. But he's not saying if you younger widows don't all get married, you're out of the church. There's no indication of that at all, that the younger widows have to make their own decisions. But that they ought to seriously consider the advice of a very wise man as well in that regard. So he can't force them, and I don't think he's saying you've got to do this at all odds. He's saying this is what I desire, and I base this on some reasonable, logical thinking and conclusions. Again, very much something that's lost in today's society is logic. However, he can offer sound apostolic advice that these younger women should seriously consider. Nine, the verb boulomai, to want or to will, is certainly used here to indicate that Paul has thought these issues through carefully and has come to a reasonable conclusion, which is both logical and spiritual. 10, the main verb is followed by three complementary infinitives. Three of which, you know, that should be four, I'm sorry. Correct that. Three of which are positive directives, while the fourth provides the reasoning behind the first three. And I don't know if we're doing it or not, but if you make corrections in these notes and we upload them, we probably ought to correct the stuff on the web where I make blunders like this and upload the corrected version. So they don't think, well, this idiot can't count. there are actually four complementary infinitives. One of them is negative, though, and I think when I wrote this, I was just looking at the three positive ones. But 11, Paul counsels the younger widows to get married, which he knows that they will likely desire to do in many cases in order to fulfill their need for male companionship, romance, and sex. So in a sense, Paul's giving them advice to do what they're probably going to want to do anyway. In most cases, that if a woman has had, let's assume, I know this is an assumption, but let's assume she was married, she had a good marriage, and she's young, and her husband was taken out for whatever reason, maybe he died in war, or he got killed, or we don't know, or just died of natural causes, and all of that, and she was happy. Don't you think she's going to want that again? I mean, that naturally, wouldn't you assume that she would? I mean, I kind of would. I would assume that if she had a happy, productive marriage, that she's going to want that again. And that she has needs. And again, I don't think it's all strictly sexual, but that's a part of it. But the companionship and the camaraderie and the romance and all of that. Women seem to like getting flowers and candy. Now, see, I can't understand that. I don't get it. Why? They're just going to die. The candy. Well, see, I'm like, you know, buy me a jet ski. or something on that order. And women like, you know, romance, and they tend to watch, you know, kinds of shows. You know, they call them chick flicks for a reason. And I have to confess, some of them I've liked. God help me. Some of them are entertaining and, you know, all that. But you understand that about women. And, again, while it doesn't necessarily trip a man's trigger, that they like this sort of thing. And, again, if she's had a happy marriage, why wouldn't she want another one? Why would she want to be alone and have to take care of herself and all that? So the verb boulomai here again is indicates that Paul has thought through this. So he counsels the younger widows, verse 11, to get married, which he knows they will likely desire to do in many cases, in order to fulfill their needs. And he doesn't seem to denigrate these needs that I can tell. I think he just recognizes this is the natural course of things. And that this, again, this advice is very fundamentally sound, even from a logical human perspective, I think. So he counsels them to get married. 12, the second piece of advice is that once they are married, they are to continue in the natural course of things and bear children. They should have babies. Now, is Paul commanding all all you women, you need to have babies? I mean, are we going to make that a doctrine? I don't think so. I think that he recognizes that this fulfills women. Now, there's exceptions to this. Some women aren't fulfilled by having children. That's just the nature of some women. That's their choice. And but he does recognize that for those who have raised children and had children and all of that, when you look back over it, I mean, wasn't there a certain amount of satisfaction that went with that? If you did your job right and your children, and especially if they grow up to be productive believers and all of that and plug into the local church and you have good fellowship with them and those kinds of things, well, yeah, that makes parenting is very, very satisfying at a certain level. Now, is parenting hard work? Yeah, from the time they're born, you're on the clock pretty much 24/7. Don't have any delusions about that. And, of course, even once they're grown and all of that and they're out of the house, you just quit caring right then, right? You just turn it off. Hey, I'm done parenting. No, of course not. You can't. You don't. Now, obviously, you have to make them stand on their own 2 feet and grow up and, you know, all that. And there's a certain amount of separation that comes in because of the virtue of the fact they move. And they might live in another place. And, well, that's fine. That's a part of the normal course of life. Children grow up and they move away. Now, or some don't. So, but again, the natural course is that they would, you know, we would assume, naturally have babies. Of course, they didn't have all the methods of birth control we have today either. But that's another whole issue. Well, 13, while some have adopted the view that children are an inconvenience that one should avoid, such is not the viewpoint expressed by the Bible. We saw it in the earlier part of this book in chapter 2, verse 15, that a part of the female's phase 2 sanctification is involved in marriage and having children, that this protects them at a certain level, delivers them from certain STA things that they could otherwise get into. It also protects them from the temptation to go out here and listen to all these false teachers. Because if you're busy raising children, again, it takes a lot of time and effort, as any of you that have children or have had children know that it does. Also, Psalm 127, 3. Behold, children are a gift of the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward, not a burden. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. How blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. They shall not be ashamed when they speak with their enemies in the gate. In other words, the children can give you great cause to be proud as well when they do well. And you'll have both extremes. I mean, you'll have immense disappointment from time to time, and you'll have this extreme legitimate pride in them when they do well. And that'll vary. I mean, kids are like everybody else. They're going to go through their deals. They're going to be up. They're going to be down. They won't just grow in a nice straight line. It'd be great if we all did, but it doesn't work that way. So again, here the Bible views this, and clearly one of the things that would happen for having children, and I don't, again, I wouldn't encourage people, well, just have children because you might be old someday and you'll need somebody to take care of you. But that is a positive part of this, that your children then have responsibilities later on. But I wouldn't encourage people to have babies so you can be safe later. They might not like you anyway. They might not take care of you. They might just put you in a home. So those of us that are somewhat older, probably 50 and up, and maybe some of them are younger, I don't know. We've seen the generation, our parents, they're going to live and die in their house. You're not going to get them out. This isn't going to be an issue. I mean, you can try if you want, I suppose, but it won't happen probably. 14, for the younger widow to have babies may very well indicate that she had not borne children in the previous marriage. And I would assume that this indicates, too, that she is still of childbearing age. But, again, you might have a widow who is 58. She might not necessarily have children. So, again, these are sort of general commands to be understood, or not commands, I would say apostolic advice, to be understood as what Paul perceives to be the best course of action in all of this, and to continue in that. Well, 15, this has some benefits for the younger woman and at least one for the local church of which she is a part. As we saw in chapter 2, point A, raising children is a source of spiritual deliverance from false doctrine, false teachers, and from our own sin nature at some level. A part of motherhood demands, of course, that you get to experience now as a mother authority that you don't have otherwise. And so you have to deal with issues of authority now. Whereas before, if you don't have any children, you got the husband as the authority, and you don't have anybody who you have to exercise authority over, other than yourself, of course. And so you get to see authority from a whole different angle now. You get to see that it isn't always fun being the one in charge, that you have to make hard and difficult decisions sometimes. And mothers get to find out what it means to be a disciplinarian, where if you don't have children, you don't have to deal with that. And we recognize that in most normal homes throughout history, history would vindicate this, that the father is generally the primary disciplinarian, but he's not to be the only one. The mother has to enforce rules in the household as well. And so when our kids were young, I would tell them, if you don't obey your mom, that's fine. And if I come home and find out about it after she spanks you, I'm going to spank you. You're going to get two spankings if you don't obey her. You disobey me, you only get one. But you disobey her, you're going to get two. And so I backed her authority up. And as a husband, of course, you got to do that. But also, then there's the issues of her own sin nature, the temptation to be idle, the temptation to get involved in inappropriate stuff. And that's the 1 Timothy 2:15 passage we just looked at. B, having children also demands the time and attention necessary to their physical and spiritual development, which removes the temptation to be idle. Ephesians 6:4. This applies to both sets of parents, but here we'll apply it to the mom too. Actually, this applies to the father, but I don't think the mother's off the hook in this verse. And fathers tend to be more into the deal of provoking their children with unreasonable demands, but mothers can do that as well. We've seen mothers provoke their kids with demands that no child could live up to. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. And again, while that is addressed to fathers, by implication, I would think mothers have to bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord as well. And so one of the things it removes, too, is when you're a parent, you have to become a lot more selfless because you have to devote yourself to somebody else now. And that removes some temptations to self-centeredness and all of that. That is another factor that would go into this. 1 Timothy, also 5:13, which is our verse, I guess. That's the idler's thing. And then C, in her old age, she would have the family to provide for her if necessary. Now, that's not to say it's always going to be necessary. Again, I think while this verse doesn't, or these verses don't say anything about life insurance, I believe most normal men want to take care of their wives after their death if they were to die before them. And so most of us have life insurance. The Bible doesn't teach about life insurance at all. It's not even ever mentioned. But yet we have it. And it seems to me to be a good, sound financial practice You know, if you can't afford it, that's a whole different deal. But if you can't afford it, you want to try to provide for your wife, I would think. I mean, I do. I assume I'm normal in that regard. Well, this would thus relieve the local church of that responsibility. 1 Timothy 5:4 deals with the children and grandchildren passage. All right, well, we're going to stop early today, so I will. We will have a brief meeting of the membership so you can get your things in order. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit enlighten us in Christ's name. Amen.